on golf today. Rory McIlroy is back on top of the world. We review his rise up the ranks, and our colleague Paul McGinley stops by to give us his thoughts on McIlroy's impressive year. Plus, the PGA Tour heads to the island of Bermuda with full FedEx Cup points on the line. Who will capitalize on the opportunity and avoid the Bermuda Triangle? And it's a special date in history for the latest LPGA champion, Lydia Ko. We look back at her career and look ahead. Is she currently the best player in the women's game at her best? We discuss.
Golf Today.
We've got live golf coming up in just a little bit. Coverage of the Eastlake Cup comes your way at 3 p.m. Eastern time right here on Golf Channel. Looking forward to match play kicking off today with some semi-final play from Eastlake. As we say good afternoon and welcome you into Golf Today, Cara Banks alongside Eamon Lynch, although really he should be welcoming me because this is my first time at the Golf Today desk with you.
I defer to the senior talent, but did you draw the short straw getting me? What do you normally do with your days when you're not here with me?
It's a good question. Yesterday, actually, I was lucky enough to be invited to Baltusrol Golf Club. I was helping out HSBC, but ran into Trevor Immelman and Davis Love III. And you know what? It was the first time I had seen Trevor since President's Cup. We were there on site, but I didn't actually interact with him during that week at Quail Hollow. And I said to him, I felt like a proud friend. Like, I really did, watching what he did that week, even though, you know, they lost 12.5 to 17.5. I was really impressed by his role as captain, what he did to grow the team, the unity, the shield, the brand, the team dinners, the themes. Carmenita, his wife, was kind of revealing a little bit about the gifts and the food every night on Twitter. But then it was interesting to talk to him about, you know, what's coming next for Trev. He's also
a big job
gearing up to sit alongside Jim Nance, isn't he, next season on CBS. He's still got a few more weeks with us on Golf Channel. We've been able to listen to him on our coverage recently. It was actually great to hear him call Tom Kim's win, winning the Shriners Hospital for Children Open. And it's kind of amazing to see a lot of these members of the international team. It's like they've got the President's Cup bounce, right? They're playing well. Cam Davis is playing well. Sung Jae-im.
Trevor did a flame under those guys. Right. He really did.
And one thing he did tell me that was interesting is that he's going to fly out to a few football games this fall to spend some time with Jim Nance, get to know him a bit better before they kick off their coverage at the Farmers in January. So that was yesterday. This is today.
No chance that we're going to get Trevor to do another go-around as the international captain of the President's Cup?
It's highly expected, I think, that Mike Weir will be captain, won't he? It'll be in Canada. It'll be a home gig for him. But I think Trevor will still be part of the team one way or another, perhaps as an assistant captain. He's so invested, it seems, in the future of this team. And on that point, you know, someone did ask the question about comments that Paul McGinley had made on Live From that week of the President's Cup, potentially making a mixed event and bringing internationals, you know, women into both the international and the American team, because we know how strong women's golf is, you know, not only here in the United States, but internationally, and how that would strengthen the team. And so many people applauded his idea, including me, because I thought it was a wonderful idea. But then we all kind of actually took a step back and ate our words, because the President's Cup ended up being such a wonderful display of golf. These comments were before a ball was hit in competition. On paper, it looked so topsy-turvy, and everyone was looking ahead thinking, gosh, is this going to be a competition that will have longevity because of the competition? And Trevor actually said that Paul texted him and apologised because he didn't mean to undermine the value of the international team and the brand that they're trying to grow at the President's Cup.
I'm still with Paul on that one, though, because 12.5 to 17.5 is still a pretty big differential. I do think it would be a more compelling event to add women in there. Maybe it's an issue of timing. In terms of when the tournament's going on, it becomes a more delicate conversation to have. That may be sort of the difference between Paul and Trevor on that one, but I still think it's an idea worth pursuing at some point.
Well, that's interesting, because Paul McGinley is joining us in just a few minutes, so you will be able to ask him yourself if he still agrees with his very own idea, or if he
Paul has never agreed with me on anything, so probably not.
Stay tuned for that. Before we do welcome in fact, Paul McGinley, let's just remind you how things look in terms of the official world golf ranking. Rory McIlroy has re-ascended. What a moment it was for him in South Carolina at the weekend. The ninth time he has now sat atop these world rankings, 10 years after he originally escalated all the way to number one in the official world golf ranking. So let's take a look back, Eamon, at the year and really the last 6 months in terms of his rise to the top spot in the world. You've got to go back to Augusta National and what a finish that was for him at the 72nd hole. He shot a 64 on Sunday and had one of the best celebrations we saw all week after holing out from the bunker on 18.
That was one of the most memorable roars you're ever going to hear at Augusta National that Sunday, Cara.
It was tied for the best round on the last day in Masters history. He ultimately finished three back of winner Scottie Scheffler after opening with round 73, 73 and a 71 on Saturday. That green jacket, though, still eludes him. Then don't forget, he defended a title earlier this year at the RBC Canadian Open, but you may be a little confused because it was on a different golf course and defended a title that he won in 2019.
Yeah, 3-year hiatus because of the pandemic, but he fended off Tony Finau and Justin Thomas down the final stretch that Sunday.
With an 8-under 62 it was at St George's Golf and Country Club. Then who can forget what happened at St Andrews? This one really had to hurt. Ultimately finished third at the Open, two back of Cameron Smith, having shared the 54-hole lead with Victor Hovland. Everyone thought, Eamon, this is the time he gets back in that major winning circle.
We all had his name etched on the claret jug that day, Cara, but wasn't to be. He was the only player to finish in the top 10 of all four majors this year, though, without a victory.
Amazing, though. You think he was four ahead of Smith after a birdie on 10, but it wasn't to be. It was to be, though, at Eastlake. He came back and won the Tour Championship and the FedEx Cup, arguably wrenching it out of Scottie Scheffler's hand. It was a 66 for him on Sunday to come from six back through 54 holes.
And he was six back before he even had a ball in the air with the starting strokes format from the Tour Championship, but he put the foot to the gas, and that's what the result was, an $18 million bonus.
Right, and the third time he's lifted the FedEx Cup, also in 2016 and 2019. Then just on Sunday, he successfully defended his second title of the year. Not many people have done that. This one at the CJ Cup, also a different golf course because he did win it last year in Las Vegas.
Good enough for a one-shot victory over Kurt Kitayama.
To mark his 23rd victory on the PGA Tour. So with that in mind, let's take a look at who has the most wins on tour since the beginning of the 2018 PGA Tour season. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Rory McIlroy now tops that list, the only one at double digits, one ahead of Justin Thomas, and he is one ahead of Patrick Cantlay and Dustin Johnson, although we don't expect to see Dustin Johnson adding to that tally anytime soon. How about this tweet then? A lot of reaction coming in around the world of golf for what Rory McIlroy managed to do over the weekend. Before we get to that tweet, let's listen to what he had to say. Oh, in fact, we will go to Paul McGinley's tweet. This is what he posted on Twitter saying, quote, terrific to see Rory re-establishing himself as world number one. Michael Jordan talked in The Last Dance of finding fuel and making things personal, along with the team additions of Fax, that's Brad Faxon, and Bob, that's Bob Rotella, a mental coach. There is no doubt the arrival of Liv is a flame that ignites. It's personal. So with more on that, let's welcome in Paul McGinley, who is all the way over in Dublin, Ireland. Paul, thanks for taking time to join us on this Tuesday. I know you were as happy as anyone to see Rory McIlroy reascend to this top spot in the official world golf ranking. Why do you think it's so important that he is there?
Well, I mean, with all the noises going on, Cara, around the game, and he's been very vocal in defending the tours and the traditions of the game to a large extent in terms of the history of these tournaments. And, you know, it's no surprise. I think he's always great when he's chasing something. And, you know, he's been chasing all year long. For various reasons, and it's no surprise at all for me that he got to number one. I think that's when he's at his best, and he's got a point to prove. It's get out of my way, here I come. And he was that earlier in his career, and we have seen over the years he's been number one in the world a number of times now throughout his career, but it normally follows with a bit of a trough afterwards. So I'm hoping there's going to be a bit of a plateau before that trough kicks in, you know, and get him through, certainly through the Masters next year, with a big performance there and possibly even a win.
Paul, we've had this conversation a few times where you've talked about Rory's pointy elbow phase, is the words you use to describe it, where he
you
had that get out
that,
of my
Eamon.
Way.
Well, you got you said of those.
You said he had it early in his career. Do you really think we're seeing a period now where he does have that fire back in him, where he can play with that kind of freedom that he had in youth? Because it's hard to sustain that through a career.
Absolutely, Eamon. I think, you know, he's an inspirational player in my view. You know, became very clear and evident to me the more I analysed him leading into my captaincy in 14 that, you know, when something is ignited in his head, off he goes. And, you know, he's quite an emotional player. And when the emotion is high-pitched in him, for some reason, his heart is on fire, I used to call it. And when his heart is on fire and he's chasing something, you know, get out of my way, here I come. And he won't stop till he chases it down. And, you know, in a lot of ways, going back to that Open Championship, it would have been better if Cameron Smith had a good Saturday and was two or three shots ahead of him going into the last round on Sunday. I think Rory would have been probably in a better position. But that's the way he is, you know. As I say, he's an emotional player, and that's why he's so good to watch. We all like that because we can all sense and feel that emotion in him. It's not a mechanical process. He plays incredibly quickly, and you can see that he's totally engaged mentally in what he's doing. And I think that's what Bob Rotello has done. He's highlighted that, and he's gone into that into a quite a deep way and kind of set that heart on fire and reset it and refocused him and got him to focus really, along with Brad Faxon, on what determines a winner in golf. And we all know Rory's heart. That's never been disputed. But certainly what makes a winner is your ability to shoot a score and your ability to turn three shots into two. And there's nowhere better to do that, certainly from Rory McIlroy's point of view, than in the short game. So there's been a real focus on his wedge play and his putting. And that's been illustrated in the improvement in stats, certainly over the last 8 or 9 months. And again, it's no reason when you combine that with the stellar long game that he has, and the obvious heart and desire he has, that you know, he elevates himself back up to number one again.
It's interesting, Paul, you mentioned your captaincy in 2014, because it's kind of crazy to believe that that is the last time Rory McIlroy won a major, as the year of 2014. You also mentioned the Masters and, of course, that green jacket that still eludes him, desperate to secure that career Grand Slam. You know, I was speaking, as I mentioned a moment ago, to Trevor Immelman yesterday. He said, I kind of wish the Masters was the next week because of the form that Rory's in. Do you think one of the biggest challenges for him to win a green jacket is this long build-up we have, the long wait for the first major of the season to come next April?
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly trying to sustain the form that he's on at the moment. Cara is obviously not easy in this game. We all know that. But, you know, he's going to be there or thereabouts, and he'll have a good early season schedule. He'll be kind of get that combination between priming himself with regards to rest and also playing as he leads himself into Augusta National. But the biggest challenge, and again, where Bob Rotello comes in, the biggest challenge is the one of expectation. It's one of the biggest challenges any sports person has. And the higher up you go in the food chain, and he's right at the very top, the more the expectation comes on top of you. And it's a difficult friend or foe is expectation, you know, and turning it into a positive light is a difficult thing to do. It's a reframing in your own mind. And as I say, if Rory can get that chasing mentality going into Augusta National rather than somewhat of a defensive mentality, I think that's when he's at his best.
Rory's obviously been very vocal on the broader issues in the world of golf, particularly around LIV Golf and the reaction to that. You've been pretty vocal as well. You've given some interviews in which you've pushed back quite strongly against narratives being pushed by LIV players. Why have you felt the need to do that?
I think, you know, Rory used the word propaganda. And I think there's certainly part of that out there. There's obviously a lot of bots involved in social media. Again, that's been well documented. And there's a lot of false information out there, Eamon, that is, you know, when you're in a direct line of fire like I am as a board member of the European Tour, it's hard to take when there's misinformation out there. And players, remember, are reading this misinformation and believing it. And it's really, really hard to take. And, you know, unreasonable conclusions are drawn from false information. And there's been a lot of unreasonable conclusions being drawn and narratives put out there. And, you know, I like to feel like I'm a straight shooter, and sometimes I get it right, sometimes I get it wrong. Like the point that Cara made earlier there with Trevor Immelman, it wasn't the time or the place for me. I should know, you know, the boots that Trevor was in, not to highlight that on the Monday or Tuesday of President's Cup. But anyway, that's a side issue. But I like to think that I am a straight shooter, and you know, I've been very much in direct line of everything that's gone, certainly from a European Tour and DP World Tour perspective, how our alignment has evolved with the PGA Tour, and also, you know, how we're dealing with the threat of LIV and why we've had to take such a firm stance against our players. You know, many of our members, and a lot of them, you know, very good friends of mine and guys that I not long played alongside in Ryder Cup, but led as well as captain. And you can imagine how difficult that is for me personally to have to do that. But I believe the right thing to do. You know, you can't play both sides here. When you're part of LIV, you are building up a competitor that is going to hurt the collective that you've left. So, you know, it's not right that you should be entitled or think that it's your right to play both sides. Now, that is my view. They don't agree with that, but that is my view very clearly. And that's where I say I'm trying not to make this thing anyway personal. It's a business and I have to represent the business of the European Tour. And that business represents 500 members, not just the elite players.
You've said there's false information out there that players are believing. Are they believing it because the DP World Tour hasn't done a good enough job of countering it? Because we're starting to see just now, and it's taken a while, what the PGA Tour future looks like. What does the DP World Tour future look like to you as part of this strategic alliance?
Yeah, you know, look, I think you can never, you know, no matter where you go in business, Eamon, no matter, you look at politics, I mean, you can never communicate too good. You can never communicate too well. And yeah, you know what, I think we've got a great communications team in the DP World Tour. And, you know, but just the avalanche of misinformation that's been coming our way has been very, very difficult to deal with. And we didn't have a lot of platforms to get it out there in terms of tournaments that we were hosting, certainly over the summer period. Once the Scottish Open was over, we didn't really have a highlighted event that the world attention was going to be on us with a big media contingent there in order to address a lot of the misinformation that was out there. Keith Pelly was traveling at least once every two, maybe 3 weeks, onto the European Tour, meeting with the players, telling them straight, this is the story. Don't believe this. This is the story. And yet still that misinformation, that whispering on the range and, you know, that noise that came through social media and the noise that came from a lot of the LIV players, which was very damaging to us. You know, but going back to your question on the PGA Tour, you know, I think this is in terms of the scheduling, you know, and Rory has talked about it earlier as well, too. 2024 is where we're really going to see the benefit of this strategic alliance in terms of scheduling. You know how difficult it is and complex it is to put it in place and to negotiate and talk with all of the, not just the sponsors and partners of the European Tour, but also the players as well, too, and get commitment for them to play. So, you know, I think in the next few months, you're going to see some conclusions to that. You're going to see some broad visions of what 2024 will look like in terms of a world schedule, which will be a combination of the PGA Tour, which will be finishing in August. And then, you know, hopefully we will take up the mantle for the second half of the year, certainly in the fall of the year. And, you know, because we are over here in Europe with a time difference, you know, we're not going to go into direct competition with American football, which is a big worry and why the PGA Tour finishes as early as it does. You know, and OK, it might be breakfast TV of European events on, but hopefully there are going to be some really big events with huge crowds, huge prize monies and all the best players playing. But that's still to be determined yet. And there's a lot of talks going on behind the scenes. I can assure you it's absolutely foot down. We are fighting on so many different levels here. To get things in place and you know, dealing with communication as well, too, on top of all that, it makes it incredibly difficult. And, you know, in some ways, yeah, we might have been, you know, overworked in terms of the amount of work that was coming the way. But we'll get through there and we'll get there.
That is exciting. You have planted a seed of curiosity. That would be a fascinating calendar to enjoy. And I know that you have been preaching patience. I've seen you on Twitter and, of course, to the players, just to patiently wait for what is promised to come. Let me just pick up on that side story you mentioned, Paul, quickly, not relevant necessarily to this conversation right now, but I think very noble of you to do what you did and reach out to Trevor and apologise, in theory, for the idea that you had, the idea that was so heralded because everyone is, I think, desperate to see a mixed match play competition in the world of golf. But do you now agree that the President's Cup is perhaps not the time to do that?
Yeah, you know, I do. In hindsight, yes, Cara. And as I say, you know, when you're doing live TV and, you know, you're calling it as it is, and as you see it, you know, you don't always get things right. And even though a lot of people agreed on it, Eamon in one and agreed on it, and there certainly was a lot of positive people who came back on that with agreement on it, I think it wasn't the place or the time to do it when Trevor was preparing his team, particularly in light of the challenges he was facing that week with so many of his players, his top players, having defected over to LIV, and they were really a weakened team. And, you know, for somebody like me who's been there as a captain and knows what it's like to kind of stick the boot in a little bit at that particular time, I got that wrong. And, you know, that's why I sent a text to Trevor on that. Having said that, I really do believe that a team event would be brilliant. And I think with the strength of the international ladies, would really increase the chances of an international win. Now, I don't think the President's Cup is, in hindsight, again, is the right place to do that. But with this new cultivated world schedule and new ideas that have been put on the table, and remember, as I say, it's incredibly complex at the moment. But with that being put on the table, you know, why not add a new team event in with ladies and men as part of it? And I think it would be great. It would grab the attention. And imagine how much fun the captain would have as well, too, when it comes to foursomes and putting the pairings together and then the different tee boxes and the different skill sets. I mean, there's so many brilliant narratives around it for not just the team, but people like me in the media to be able to commentate on it as we kind of unpick what the captains are doing and their strategy towards it. So I think there's a time and a place for it. But I don't think the President's Cup is. Like you, I was very impressed with what Trevor did with a lot of headwinds against them. I know, as Eamon says quite rightly, it still was a heavy scoreline against them. But there was certainly a lot of seeds there, a lot more seeds than I've seen in the past, to think that this international team is closer than they've ever been. Well, maybe I'll correct myself a little bit there, because they were very, very close in Melbourne. I thought coming away from Melbourne, they left it behind them. I thought the international team were the better team that week, and it was a shame they didn't win. You know, America did very well to stay within touching distance, and then their strength came through in the singles. They were very nearly blown out of it the way the first few days. And I thought, you know what, going on down to Quail Hollow in 2 years' time, I think this internationals will pick the pocket. But obviously that didn't happen because of the lived affections to a large extent.
Well, Paul, let's move from one controversial team composition to another. In the Ryder Cup, Adrian Otegi won on the DP World Tour a couple of weeks ago. He's now back playing LIV this week. He's actually qualified in the very early numbers by the world's point list for the European Ryder Cup team, which will obviously change a lot between now and then. Is there any appetite among players on the DP World Tour to have LIV guys be part of that team to be competitive?
There's not a strong appetite, let's put it that way, Eamon. And I think that appetite will evolve as the year goes on, one way or the other, particularly when we come to February and our court case is going to be heard and it is a definitive position then hopefully taken that the European Tour, DP World Tour, can take. You know, Luke has been very shrewd in giving himself extra leeway with six picks. So that gives him a little bit more optionality. And, you know, Adrian Otegi is going to be an interesting one. For one, certainly he looks like a hell of a player, and to shoot the scores that he did around Valderrama was highly impressive. And certainly we're looking for a lot of young guys to start moving their way into the team, because we are going through a changing of the guard to a large extent on the European team. But a lot of the players that were in Whistling Straits are obviously not going to be playing next year. But we have the backbone. You know, I reckon we've six or seven really, really strong players there that will almost certainly make the team. And then when you throw in the likes of maybe Alex Noren or Francesco Molinari or Thomas Peters returning to form, which now they've all showed some form recently, along with the young guys like Bob McIntyre, who won around that golf course only last month, I think we're going to have a pretty good team here. Whether the LIV guys are going to be part of that, I think, you know, we got to let some more water go under the bridge before that. But I think it will be it'll be a bit of a surprise if they do. Certainly, judging by the sentiment at the moment, and you know, I know emotions are very highly charged at this moment in time, but it's a long way off for the LIV players to be part of that. But again, I think a lot of it will determine the court case, you know, and if they win that court case and they're entitled to be members of the DP World Tour, well, then Adrian Otegi and all the rest of them will have a chance to qualify for the team.
You're right there. The backbone does look strong, even just after this last weekend, Paul. Good performances, obviously, by Rory, but John Rahm. Let's not forget Tyrrell Hatton, Matt Fitzpatrick, Victor Hovland. So there is a core central line down that European team who continue to perform well on both sides of the pond. Thanks for taking time out to speak to us on this Tuesday. Enjoy the rest of your evening back home in Dublin, and we'll catch up with you again soon.
Thanks, Cara. Thanks, Eamon.
It's interesting what he said, because, and we don't need to delve into this too deeply now, but it would feel a little bit hypocritical if players that had defected to LIV at any point, like an Adrian Otegi, were ultimately allowed to play on the European Ryder Cup team, given the fact that Henrik was stripped of his captaincy because of his allegiance. Kind of would seem a little bit of a double standard, perhaps, to then have players in the team that had done similar.
It perhaps would, and particularly in the case of Henrik, who had signed a contract and given an explicit assurance that he wasn't going to do what he then did. So I think there's a different element to it, I suppose, with the captain than with the players, because there's always uncertainty in who's going to make the team as players for at least half of the team over the course of a couple of years. There shouldn't be any uncertainty around the captain. And I think there was a different dynamic on that. But I do think the European Ryder Cup chances next year are being a little, to use Ian Poulter's phrase, it's a little previous to say that they're being diminished to the extent that they are. Because when you talk about some of the guys you mentioned, like a Rory, a John Rahm, Victor Hovland, Matt Fitzpatrick, there's a pretty strong core in there. You add Shane Lowry to that group as well. And then a lot of the guys who've been playing well recently, like a Danny Willett, a Bob McIntyre, Sepp Straka, there are all of these guys who are a pretty solid group of players, because European Ryder Cup teams historically have always been based around maybe four or five tentpole characters. And it's always been the kind of the journeymen who've stepped up in Ryder Cups. You know, Philip Price taking down Phil Mickelson in singles, Jamie Donaldson hitting that shot into the last at Glen Eagles to win the Ryder Cup. So I think it's a little hasty to suggest, as we've seen a lot, that the European Ryder Cup guys are substantially worse underdogs this year than they've been before. I don't necessarily think that's the case.
Yeah, I agree. I think there was just a bit of concern after Whistling Straits, wasn't there? But that's also due to the fact that a lot of the European stalwarts weren't playing their best golf that week, including Rory McIlroy. And as we turn the conversation back to him, you know, fascinating, of course, to have Paul McGinley's thoughts. But I think, you know, Whistling Straits last year was a pretty pivotal moment in this kind of rise that Rory has had once again in the game. You know, breaking down in tears, knowing that he didn't deliver what he knew he could for the European team that week. And he has gone down a few little paths that have led the wrong way. And he's had the maturity ultimately to stop and turn around and come back. He gave some great advice to Tom Kim last week at the CJ Cup, said, don't go chasing distance, trust me. You'll get there as you get bigger and stronger and spend time in the gym. But, you know, he did leave Michael Bannon for a little bit, go to work with Pete Cowan. He was trying to improve, go down the Bryson DeChambeau route, realise that that wasn't working for him. Ultimately, I think you have to stick with what you know best. And that has been the case now for Rory McIlroy. Question is, how long does he hold on to this kind of form?
Well, that's the mystery of this game, isn't it? How long you hold on to this kind of form. Rory's team right now looks pretty stable. The Cowan experiment really was a disaster. I mean, his worst ball-striking performances of his career largely came during that 6 months with Pete Cowan. But he's got it stabilised now with Michael Bannon, with Brad Faxon, and as Paul mentioned there, with Bob Rotella, his mental game coach. The team seems pretty solid. The game seems pretty solid as well. The question is whether, as we posed earlier, you know, is Rory's best golf ahead of him? That's a tough standard when you've been as good as early in your career as Rory McIlroy has. But there is headroom there. I mean, if you compare Rory McIlroy with some of the greats that we've seen in this game, in terms of what he's accomplished at this age, 33 years, 174 days old. Well, the three guys you see on the right, that's a pretty high standard with Tiger, Jack and Arne, and Rory's adrift of all of those. But look where Phil Mickelson was at this point at 33. He didn't have any of his major championships that he now has, and Rory has four. So, you know, there's a great deal of headroom here for Rory. Phil Mickelson won six majors after this age. Now, is Rory's best golf ahead of him? It might be behind him, but there's still some pretty darn good golf ahead of him.
And I think that's what everyone wants to see, is another major, isn't it? I think, you know, everyone is a standard, including Rory himself. It's been 8 years since he's won a major, but that graphic is fascinating. Brandel Chamblee also put out a tweet at the weekend that just really made you kind of stand up and go, okay, there could still be a lot left in the tank. Because of Phil, no major championships at this age. He'd never won a Players. He'd never been number one in the official World Golf Ranking. He'd never won a Varden Trophy. So I think, you know, we hope that there is a lot more left in Rory McIlroy's career, but he spoke very honestly after the win at the CJ Cup on Sunday, just about, you know, what a different person he is. You know, he's a father now, he's a husband. He said, of course I'm not going to be the same guy that I was before Poppy was born. There was that really cute video released online of the PGA Tour with him on FaceTime to Poppy and wishing her good night, go have a bath and a good night's sleep and I'll come in and wake you up in the morning. And, you know, there is the life balance right there of the man that he is now that he wasn't when he won these major championships. One more thing that was on social media at the weekend that I also thought was very insightful was a look at the top 10 in the official World Golf Ranking when he first ascended to number one, which was all the way back in 2012, March of that year, after he won the Honda Classic. Just look at this list. Luke Donald, of course, the now European Ryder Cup captain. Lee Westwood, Martin Kaymer, they're over playing LIV Golf, but, you know, certainly towards the end of their competitive playing careers on the PGA Tour anyway. Steve Stricker's on the PGA Tour Champions, Webb Simpson, Jason Day, Dustin Johnson's also at LIV, but he's the highest ranked currently of the 10 that were on this list back in 2012. Charles Schwartzel and Hunter Mahan. I mean, it's amazing that Rory McIlroy is still there, or back there, I should say, 10 years later.
There's a lot of roadkill on that list, and roadkill piles up quickly in this game. You know, it's a fickle game to play for a living for these guys, and it's a great testament to Rory McIlroy's endurance that here we are 10 and a half years later, and he's back to the very top of the world rankings and looks as though he could be quite comfortable there for a while. But as you say, he's definitely a different person now than he was then, because he lived, breathed and ate golf back then. It was all-consuming. It's not all-consuming now. He's obviously got a family life. He's got a thriving business investment portfolio that he works on a lot as well, different projects that he's doing with Tiger. There's a lot more in Rory McIlroy's life now than just golf. But that doesn't necessarily mean, I suppose, that the intensity is and the ambition is any less than it was before. He certainly gives the impression of a guy in conversation who wants it every bit as badly as he did. Some cases, when it comes to that majors, maybe he wants it a little bit too badly, because it's not as though he's been out there floating around on a cloud for 8 years. You know, he's got those three FedEx Cups. He's won a Players' Championship. He's won more tournaments even in the last 4 years on the PGA Tour than anyone else. So it's not as though he's under-accomplished. He's just still being held to the standard he set, which was enormously high in the early days of his career.
We all got ahead of ourselves at St Andrews, didn't we? Erica and Poppy were there. His parents were there. It was all set to be this wonderful stage on Sunday. And, you know, you can't get too far ahead of yourself, because there was still 18 holes of golf left to play. And, of course, he wasn't the man that came out on top. So with that in mind, our social question of the day today is this. Rory McIlroy is back to number one in the world, but is his best golf still ahead of him? Tell us what you think for a chance to be featured later on today's show. We look forward to those responses.
Well, the PGA Tour is in Bermuda this week, but don't expect a relaxed island vibe. While the superstars spend the week at home in their hammocks, it's an opportunity for someone else to get a head start on the season. And who needs it most? We discuss next.
Welcome back to Golf Today. The PGA Tour returns to Bermuda as the island hosts the fourth playing of the Butterfield Bermuda Championship. The event will award full FedEx Cup points for the third straight year, and the winner will receive an invitation to the 2023 Masters Tournament. So let's look back at the three winners of this event, shall we? Let's go to 2019. Brendan Todd picked up his second career PGA Tour victory at Bermuda just 2 months after regaining his PGA Tour card. What a story that was. It marked his first victory on tour since the 2014 AT&T Byron Nelson. The very following year, Brian Gay also broke a winless drought as he took home the title for his first PGA Tour win since 2013. In doing so, the 48-year-old became the oldest winner at the time since Davis Love in 2015. And then last year, 25-year-old Australian Lucas Herbert won the Bermuda Championship thanks to a 2-under-69 in the final round. He held off Danny Lee and Patrick Reed for his first PGA Tour victory, which sent him to the Masters for the very first time.
And here's a look at the field for this year's Butterfield Bermuda Championship. Several major champions in there. John Daly, Lucas Glover, Luke Donald, Ryder Cup captain, in there as well. And let's hear from a couple of those guys on what they hope to accomplish this week.
For a guy that hasn't won in a few years and trying coming off an injury, that this is sort of a stepping stone that you want to build on. So this is an event that obviously I want to take advantage of, and obviously everybody that comes here wants to do that also. But it's still a PGA official PGA Tour win, and it does come with all those other benefits, and it's definitely first and foremost on the mind.
Well, I think it's great. Broadening the scope a little bit, playing some faraway places, but not that far away here, really. It feels a long way from home, but a couple-hour flight from the East Coast. But, I think Butterfield does a heck of a job for us here and stepped up, having a full field event second year. Like you said, it's great. I think a little more playing opportunities in the fall for some guys, and, just opportunity.
I think it's awesome. It's a great opportunity for some of these guys who maybe haven't gotten into all the events that they've wanted to this fall. And it's a great opportunity for the tournament to attract some past champions and other people like that. So I think it's awesome.
Yeah, it's great. I think it's the fact that it's a full point event definitely makes it more of a draw. How could you not like it here? It's paradise. But I think it's good for this event. A lot of people who run this event really care about it and do a great job, so I think it's awesome.
Is that kind of in the forefront of your mind when you come here, that this is all the stuff that you could come from, whether it be the money or, you know, Masters invitation, everything else that comes with it?
Absolutely, that was forefront of my mind. I want to make Augusta, and this is an opportunity. So why not come here and come play and go for it? You know, I think the fact that it's a full point event definitely makes me and a lot of other players more of a draw to come play here.
So we heard from a few players there. It is time now to state your case, Eamon Lynch, for a player who needs to take advantage, you think, of the opportunity this week.
You could point to pretty much anyone in the field, and that's illustrated by even the bookies, who have Denny McCarthy as a favourite this week. Denny McCarthy's never won on the PGA Tour, and that tells you how open the field is this week. I look at a guy like Seamus Power this weekend. He was tied 12th here last year, and he's going to need, I think, to improve on that this year, because we haven't seen much out of Seamus in quite a while. He won the Barracuda Championship earlier last year, 5 top 10s last season. One of them was in the PGA Championship, but he's been pretty quiet since then, and his first 3 starts of this season have been a tie for 30th, a missed cut, and a tie for 49th. And the reason that matters is he's currently number 48 in the official World Golf Rankings. Year's end, the top 50 qualify for Augusta National and the Masters, and Seamus Power is not in there yet on any other criteria. So he's the kind of guy who's hovering around that bubble of the top 50, who you would expect to see try to, you know, put the foot on the gas a little bit this week and try to deliver it, because he is one of the better players in the field. He's one of the higher ranked players in the field this week, and it's a real opportunity for a guy like him to actually deliver and try to give himself more breathing room for that Masters invite.
You know, it is amazing coming off a week like the CJ Cup that had such a deep field, maybe not as many superstars in Bermuda this week, but therefore so much opportunity for the players that are. You and I spoke before we came on air about Bill Haas, 40 years of age now, you know, perhaps wanting to try and capitalise on, you know, his next few years into his early 40s on the PGA Tour. Also, perhaps for his dad, by the way, Jay Haas, who is right up there, close to the most PGA Tour starts all time. I don't think he's going to chase it. Mark Brooks has the record right now with 103. Jay's kind of in the 790s. But, you know, if Bill retains good status, he could keep partnering with him in the Zurich Classic and notching off a few more starts. Just saying.
Well, they did make the cut last year, and Jay carried his weight in that one. He wasn't being carried by the kid that week.
Davis Love, though, by the way, told me yesterday, he really is. He's got his eye on that number. I think he's at 788 right now. He really wants to get to that mark, 803 or 804, and hold that record. It would be special. Welcome back to Golf Today. It is time now to celebrate this date in golf history. So let's flash back, shall we, to the year 2015 on this date, when Lydia Ko, at the age of 18 years old, won the LPGA Taiwan Championship by 9 strokes. It was her 10th career LPGA Tour victory, and it shattered the record for the youngest in tour history to reach double-digit wins. Nancy Lopez previously held the record and achieved 10 LPGA Tour titles at the age of 22. So now let's look back at the action over this weekend in South Korea, when Lydia secured her 18th LPGA Tour title at the BMW Ladies Championship after birdieing 3 of her final 4 holes to shoot a final round 7-under 65. It was her second victory of this calendar year, making her the 5th multiple winner on tour in 2022. And after the final round, she was emotional, explaining that she'd always wanted to win in her native South Korea, not far from her birthplace of Seoul. So you take a look then, Eamon, at the two seasons. 2015, as we mentioned, when she got to those double-digit wins, she had 5 wins that season compared to 2 so far this season, still with a few events remaining. She had 12 top fives compared to the 11 she has now, and 17 top tens compared to the 13. One of those, by the way, wins was a major title at the 2015 Evian Championship. It was interesting to hear her sound, or her interview, I should say, after that win, and that she said this perhaps is the most consistent golf she'd played of her career. We were talking about that on Golf Central post-game on Sunday evening, and we said, well, it may feel like it, but actually 2015 did look like a more consistent year. Nevertheless, when she is at her best, do you think she is the best player on the LPGA Tour?
I'm not going to give in to this recency bias that we're all tempted to here with Lydia Ko. I mean, she's certainly the most consistent. That's very clear. 2015 was more to me about excellence, and she had a lot more trophies in hand. This year, she leads the Vera Trophy for scoring average on the LPGA Tour pretty comfortably, actually. Right now, she's at 69.051. The gap between Lydia Ko and the Vera Trophy between first and second is the same as the gap between second and ninth. She's got a very comfortable lead in that. So she is definitely the most consistent player on the tour right now. But I still think at her best, I still think Jing Yun Ko is a little bit better. And there's a tendency to let the current injury cloud the assessment of Jing Yun Ko. And she's had a struggle this season to some extent. She has won this season, but she still had some struggles. But if you go back to the first round at the Chevron, that broke a streak of 34 rounds under par that she had running. And the tournament that she just had a disaster at in South Korea, when she went back there last year, she shot a 71 in the first round, and that ended a streak of 16 consecutive rounds in the 60s. And, you know, that's a heck of a streak to go on when you're going from different venue to different venue against different competition in different countries all the time. I still think at her best, Jin Young Ko produces a level of golf that is a little bit better than anyone else. That's why she's still number one in the world. Lydia Ko may be consistently better, but if we're talking about in the terms of at their best, I'm giving the edge to Jin Young Ko.
You're right, the amount of cuts she's made as well. It was tough to see. I feel like maybe it was a forced return last week because, of course, it was in Korea. She was coming off that injury layoff for 8 weeks or so, issues with her wrist, and then had that, you know, horrendous hole. She got, I think, an 8 or a 10 on one of the holes, and it was just ended up being a withdrawal. So it wasn't a great return to form for her. But, you know, I think it's so hard to say, you know, who's the best at their best, because golf is such an impossible game to ever know that you've got everyone playing their absolute best on a given day. But, you know, I will say that I've been incredibly impressed by Ataya Tutukun this year. She's a 19-year-old. She's trying to be a trailblazer, actually, much like Lydia Ko was. If she had won, or in fact finished top four last weekend, she would have ascended to number one in the women's golf ranking. She would have been the youngest since Lydia Ko to do that. She, like Lydia, has had two wins this season. She's had one more top 10, actually 14 top 10s in her rookie year. It's outstanding. Lydia's had 13, albeit in a few less events. But, you know, to me, this is, you know, potentially a new superstar on the LPGA Tour.
And isn't it remarkable that we have this discussion where she's in line to be the Rookie of the Year? She's also in line to be Player of the Year and has come perilously close to becoming the world number one player as well. So when you're talking about three very disparate honours in the game and they're all in play for her, it's remarkable. But to your point of this idea of do we ever see them play against each other at their best, that's, to me, goes to the heart of what we're missing in golf on either side, whether it's men's golf or women's golf, is a rivalry where we see the best go toe-to-toe against each other. You could argue the last time we saw that in golf was probably Annika Sorenstam and Carrie Webb, going back probably 15-plus years at this stage. But golf hasn't really had a rivalry. We've had a lot of parity where guys and women will play well and go on these hot streaks, but they're not often going up against somebody else on a hot streak. I thought it was coming at the end of last year. At this point last year, we had Nelly Korda and Jin Young Ko just swapping titles week after week. And we really need that in this game. I want to see a shootout where the best are at their best against each other. And it feels as though it's been a while since we've had that.
Yeah, both have suffered with injury this year, haven't they? By the way, you mentioned Annika Sorenstam. We've got some big news on her and her new partner for the PNC Championship coming up a bit later in the show, so stay tuned for that. But first of all, let's take a look at the upcoming LPGA Tour schedule, because there are some opportunities to get a couple more victories before the season's over. Next week, the Toto Japan Classic is taking place November 3rd through 6th. That is out, of course, in Japan. Then the Pelican Women's Championship will be in Bel Air, Florida, the very following week. That is the last opportunity to get yourself inside the top 60 in the CME group standings to qualify for that season-ending tour championship that takes place at Tiburon Golf Club in Naples, Florida. It is, in fact, a big day out of Bel Air today. We'll get to that in just a moment, because we are going to focus on Brittany Altomare. She is a two-time Solheim Cup player. Finished second, by the way, at the Evian Championship in 2015. That was her best finish to date, having lost out in a playoff to Annika Sorenstam. We expect to see her at the Pelican Women's Championship. I mentioned those Solheim Cup teams, but the 31-year-old is still seeking her first victory despite coming so close in that playoff all the way back in 2017 at the Evian Championship. And we're now delighted to welcome Brittany Altomare from the Media Day at Pelican Women's Championship. Of course, looking forward to that event coming up soon on the LPGA Tour's schedule. Brittany, thanks for taking a moment to join us today. And this is quite a unique event for you because you've lived in Tampa for the last few years. So what's it like playing an event so close to your hometown? Do you think it's a help or a hindrance?
I think it's a help. I mean, it's, like you said, it's unique for golf. I mean, we're constantly traveling, living out of a suitcase. And, you know, for once I get to have a tournament where I'm like living out of my closet and staying in my own bed and being able to cook dinner and stuff. So it's nice. And I think that's a slight advantage over some. And I, you know, I've played the golf course a lot, and this golf course is a lot about the greens and like where to hit it. So I think knowing the golf course too is an advantage.
Brittany, the last couple of years, you'd been pretty much a model of consistency. You really hadn't missed many cuts. You'd had a handful of top tens. This year has been more of a struggle. Is there anything in particular in your game that you're working on as you head into this final stretch?
Yeah, I mean, I started off the year pretty okay with a top 10 finish and, you know, in Fort Myers. And, you know, like you said, it's been a little bit of a struggle this year. I just feel like I haven't been able to put four rounds together. So I just think, you know, working on just little things to help with confidence and maybe knowing the golf course this week and being at home will be like the difference.
So the tour has only a few stops left, and the last couple are in Florida, obviously, with the Pelican Championship and then the CME. You're right on the bubble for qualifying for the CME Globe at 67. Do you feel any need to get more aggressive these last couple of weeks, or does it change your approach in any respect?
Yeah, I mean, I like to play aggressive golf in general, and I think this year I really haven't, and that maybe has been one of the differences. So, you know, just getting back to being aggressive, playing to my strengths. You know, I really love putting and my wedge game and just kind of working on that. And like I said, playing to my strengths hopefully will help me this coming up week.
Brittany, it's been fun to watch you on the last couple of Solheim Cup teams, 2019 and 2021. We know Stacey Lewis takes the helm in Spain next year. We're all looking forward to that. How much is that on your radar, trying to make a third consecutive team for the United States?
Yeah, I mean, Solheim Cup has definitely been the highlight of my career, the two that I've played on. And, you know, being away or being in Scotland and playing and then playing on U.S. home soil has been, I mean, that was just an experience like none other. And, you know, that's definitely a goal every other year is to make that team. And, Stacey's been part of the last two teams that I've played on, and I saw her work so hard last year, and I thought she did an incredible job as an assistant captain, and I can't wait to see what she's going to do as a captain. I mean, I know she's already working hard, working to make some changes and improving it for us players, and, you know, hopefully we can bring back the cup in next year in 2023.
At Finca Cortesan in Andalusia. It's going to be a heck of a venue. We're looking forward to that as well. And then there's been some great storylines on the LPGA Tour this year, hasn't there? Including Jody Hewitt Shadoff, who we just saw break through for the first time. You'll know this, age 34, over 245 starts. It was quite a motivating moment, I'm sure, for someone like you who is also looking to break through for the first time on the LPGA Tour. How nice was that to see, and how much has it inspired you to perhaps do the same?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely was an inspiration. I mean, Jody has played out here for a long time, and, you know, so have I, and I've been close a few times, and just, you know, trying to break through, and, you know, it's just an inspiration that, like, you know, don't give up. You never know when your time's going to happen, and I think that's such an inspiration and motivation going forward.
Yeah, and just how hard it is to win in the professional game, right? We look forward to watching you at the Pelican Women's Championship down there in Bel Air, Florida. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us today, and good luck creeping inside that bubble. We'll be keeping a close eye on that top 60.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Still ahead on golf today, this guy has had a lot to celebrate this year, and today he's celebrating a birthday, the last of his 20s. We'll take a closer look at Xander Schauffele's career in just a little bit. Stay tuned.
Well, the PGA Tour Champions announced today the schedule for its 2023 season, which features 28 events and will conclude at the Charles Schwab Cup Championship in Phoenix, Arizona. The 25-event regular season will welcome one new tournament. That will be the Gallery Classic in Rancho Mirage, California. Of course, where the Chevron Championship used to take place for the women, players will visit 20 U.S. states and three other countries, Morocco, Wales, and Canada. Sounds like quite the trip. In 2023, players will compete for more than $66 million in total prize money. That is the highest in PGA Tour Champions 43-season history. Wow. And some more news surrounding the early wave of the PNC Championship's field has been announced. It does include some intriguing pairings. Well, the Dailies will be back to defend after beating the Woods, Tiger and Charlie by two strokes last year. No words on the Woods participant just yet, but we have heard that Jordan Spieth will be playing in the PNC Championship for the very first time with his dad, Sean Spieth. What a special moment that will be for them. And you heard us teasing some news surrounding Annika Sørenstam. Well, Her son will be teeing it up with her for the very first time at the Ritz-Carlton Orlando Grand Lakes in the PNC Championship. He has apparently been desperate to be part of this event ever since he saw Charlie Woods teeing it up with Tiger a couple of years ago. And Annika said, "We've got to work on your game, son, and when it's good enough, we'll give it a go." That time has come. Cannot wait for such a special family event with the PNC in December. And still to come on Golf Today, it has been a long season for players across the globe in golf. So as we reach the heart of the fall season, we ask the question, which player is most in need of a rest and some relaxation? We'll debate that next.
It's that time of the year when some superstars just want to hit the couch while others are keen to keep riding a hot streak. A lot of guys have earned a break, but who really needs it the most? And Xander Schauffele has some semi-notable birthday today, the last one in his 20s. We can't blow out that famous cigar of his, but we can help him with the candles. Golf Today continues now.
Golf Today.
And just a reminder that we've got live golf coming up in a little bit. Coverage of the Eastlake Cup comes your way at 3 p.m. Eastern time right here on Golf Channel. It will be match play semi-final coverage today, so looking forward to that. As we welcome you back into our Golf Today studio, Cara Banks alongside Eamon Lynch. And I like seeing those photographs of Xander Schauffele celebrating. We know he likes a cigar post the Ryder Cup or President's Cup victory, but his wife Maya was enjoying the celebrations on the back of that golf cart as well, I think. They've just been at home visiting some family in Japan, so no doubt had some extended celebrations.
Yeah, he's taken a break. He was one of the few names not visible in the CJ Cup last week. He stayed in Japan after the Zozo for an extended family visit. His wife was born in Japan. So, it's one of those times of the year where guys start to carve out a little window wherever they can. And you're going to see that become more and more of a pressing issue, Carr. We've seen what the PGA Tour schedule is going to look like in 23 and then in 24 beyond, when it's a calendar year schedule and there's a commitment to these 20 events, of which they're going to have to play at least 19 between January and August. That doesn't leave a lot of windows for time off, for other obligations or passions that they might have. So you're going to see guys, I think, in that post-FedEx Cup period, try to really take a break, try to get away from this game. Others will pursue the DP World Tour championship as well. You'll see more guys like a John Rahm, a Rory McIlroy play events in Europe, but you're going to see it become a little trickier for guys to take that break earlier in the year.
Yeah, and we're going to get to that actually in just a minute in terms of the schedule and how people feel about this portion that we're in right now. But first of all, let's remind you that the PGA Tour moves from South Carolina this week to the island of Bermuda for the Butterfield Bermuda Championship. You can catch live first round coverage on Thursday, 1:30 p.m. Eastern time right here on Golf Channel. And here's a look at the remaining PGA Tour schedule for this fall. We're in Bermuda this week. It is the Worldwide Technology Championship down in Mayakoba the following week. The Houston Open after that before the RSM Classic in Sea Island. Tiger's Hero World Challenge down in Albany. And then the QBE Shootout in Florida. That PNC Championship we were mentioning a moment ago will be the week after. And over on the DP World Tour, after three consecutive weeks in Spain, they will border hop to Portugal for this week's Portugal Masters. And first round coverage starts on Golf Channel Thursday at 8 a.m. Eastern time. So here's a look at the upcoming DP World Tour schedule with now just, a few weeks ago, I should say, world number five John Rahm captured his third Spanish Open title, matching the achievement of his hero, Seve Ballesteros. And, well, he's not playing this week in Portugal, could well head over to Dubai for the DP World Tour Championship. We'll wait to find out about that. But let's get Rory McIlroy's thoughts on the future, perhaps, of this time of year when it comes to the golf schedule.
Quickly. One other thing on the schedule. What do you think the fall will look like? What do you think it should look like?
Football. I mean, it's football season, right? I think we need to get to a place where it's not oversaturated. I would love us to come back in January and people will have missed watching competitive golf. I don't think that happens right now because there's 47 events a year. So I think to get the most fan engagement that we possibly can, we have to let people miss it for a little bit. You know, people, you know, and I'm not comparing golf to football at all, but you think about the exclusivity of the NFL, and they play, you know, 18 weeks a year, and then people are just so ready for football season to start again. I'm not saying that golf's going to be that way, but you got to let people miss it a little bit. So, and I'm not saying we're not going to play any golf in the fall, but, you know, the fall is maybe more of a international flavor. It's an opportunity for guys to travel the world a little bit, grow their brands in different countries, and but the real competitive golf season is January to August. That's where I see it.
Well, someone we won't see for a bit now is Max Homa. He is about to have his first child, admittedly, and he did recently tweet this, quote, "Dear golf, we're going to be taking a break for a little bit. It's not that I don't love you, but it's been a long year and I want to miss you again. Thank you for understanding. Please beat up on some others while I'm gone. I don't want you to get rusty. Sincerely, a tired golfer." You know, it's interesting, and I think given what McIlroy just said in that quote from Sunday at the CJ Cup, and of course what Paul McGinley said a little bit earlier on our show today, it definitely feels as if the PGA Tour is going to shut down. We know already it won't be part of the FedEx Cup in this fall portion of the year. Perhaps we'll have some big events on the DP World Tour and others that Rory McIlroy alluded to, because we do have some tired golfers at this time of the year. Max Homa just alluded to it himself. Granted, he's getting ready for another part of his life to kick into full gear. But which golfer do you think could really benefit from a rest right now?
Well, when you see the comments from Rory and Max Homa, with all due respect, that's two guys who can afford to take off the fourth quarter. There are multiple winners. There are a lot of guys out there whose bills don't stop coming in because superstars want to take a vacation. And that's really the competing reality of the PGA Tour, is on one respect creating this product where you see the best players more often together, but still providing opportunities to the rest of the players. And that hasn't really been resolved on the PGA Tour at all. When I look at the guys, you just take the top 10 of the world ranking, for example, and the starts they've made from 2021, and you look at who has racked up the most. And I look at a guy like Scottie Scheffler on this list. At this time of the year with Scottie, you tend to see him more often than you see a pumpkin spice latte. The guy works hard, or has for quite a while, but you can see here he's played more than most anybody else in the top 10 in the world rankings. At some point, substantially more. You compare him, say, Patrick Cantlay there towards the bottom of that list. That's, you know, almost 3 months worth more work that he's put in through the course of this time than Cantlay has. And Scheffler, when you look at the fall in particular over the last few years, he tends to keep up a very busy schedule. You go back to 2019, he played 7 events. 2020, he played 6. Now, in fairness, that also included the Masters that year. And even last year, he played 5. And he doesn't need to do that anymore. He's no longer chasing traction. He's no longer trying to secure playing status. He's a 4-time winner out here. He's a major champion. Doesn't need to do it. And he isn't going to do it, because I believe his only other remaining commitments for the rest of this year are to play in Houston and to play the Hero. So the rest is coming. And, you know, when you look at those numbers, Scottie Scheffler certainly earned it.
Yeah, he definitely felt, I think, like he needed to get to a certain level in the game, which no doubt he's obviously achieved now. Of course, Masters champion, former world number one, 4-time winner this year. And I'm sure it's hard to kind of dip in and even just play the odd event like the Houston Open when you're kind of shutting it down for a week off. It's hard to rev the engines up and get back to PGA Tour ready for 1 week of the year. But we had started to see Scottie Scheffler show a bit more emotion on the golf course, a bit more frustration, even just last week at the CJ Cup, you know, definitely perhaps showing some fatigue. We never kind of saw those characteristics from Scottie Scheffler a few months ago. So maybe he will benefit from some time away. My mind goes to Jon Rahm. You know, I think for these international, particularly European players, particularly the leaders like a Rory McIlroy or Jon Rahm, who are expected and wanted and sought after so much in their home countries, they do take on a lot more with a bit of an international schedule. They were both overplaying the BMW PGA Championship at Wentworth, but, you know, Jon Rahm did then go and play at home in Spain. What an emphatic, emotional victory that was, getting his third National Open title, much like Seve Ballesteros. And he had some comments to say on Sunday after a good performance at the CJ Cup, but how he needed some rest as well. Let's take a listen.
Yeah, looking forward to some time off. Will not touch a club for the foreseeable future. Very needed. And, you know, weather forecast is great in Scottsdale, so time to be a dad and enjoy some benefits of of having, you know, of a good play, good fall, and just be home and again be dad and have a good time for a little bit.
Yeah, be dad to two young boys now. They have Baby and Echo just in August. Of course, they've got Kepa as well. Mm-hmm. 2 under 2, I think. So it's a busy time in the Rahm household. It'll be interesting to
you
see when
he plays.
Do you
think he'd want to leave and go play golf with that amount of noise at home?
Probably get some more sleep on the road. I can attest to that. By the way, pumpkin spice lattes. I heard you mention them. Is that your flavour of taste this time of the year?
I have never had a cup of coffee in my life.
Really?
I lead a very clean life.
Wow.
You seem unconvinced.
How can you know that you don't like it if you've never tasted it?
And I can also tell John Rahm that from my experience, you don't become a happier person by not touching the clubs at all. It just makes you a little more miserable. Maybe I do need coffee and golf in my life.
That and any more advice you've got from John Rahm, I'm sure he'll happily take it from Golf Today's very own Eamon Lynch. We'll be back in a minute bringing out the birthday cake for one of golf's most talented players. Xander Schauffele has a birthday today. We'll celebrate his accomplishments next. Welcome back to Golf Today, and it is time to get out the birthday cake and do some celebrating as Xander Schauffele turns 29 today. So we are wishing Mr. Schauffele a very happy birthday. Let's look back, shall we, at some of his recent accomplishments. Well, this past April in New Orleans, this was a good moment with a good friend. Eamon teamed up with Patrick Cantlay to take the team title at the Zurich Classic of New Orleans.
Yeah, finally gave them a reason to enjoy and celebrate their annual trips to the wine country of Napa, California. And they can afford to split the bill on that one, too.
They sure can. They held off Sam Burns and Billy Horschel by 2 strokes. It was Xander's 5th PGA Tour victory. He then got it done solo as we fast forward to June when he was in the winner's circle in Cromwell, Connecticut, winning the Travelers Championship for his 6th PGA Tour victory after a dramatic 3-shot swing on the final hole.
And that ended his solo drive, which had stretched back to the 2019 Century Tournament of Champions.
Yeah, he had really wanted an individual victory. He got it there and then continued that good form, by the way, that summer, capturing yet another victory in a co-sanctioned Genesis Scottish Open. He was 11 off the lead after the first round, but able to secure the win by 1.
And that was his 2nd consecutive victory and a 2nd consecutive start. He hadn't played between Travelers and the Genesis Scottish Open.
His 4th win in 12 months, so certainly an improvement when it comes to 2022. Let's take a look then at the year in review. He got those 3 victories that we just mentioned, 8 top 10 finishes in some 20 PGA Tour starts. He finished in the top 15 in 3 majors, 4th at the Tour Championship, and went 3-1-0 to help the United States win the President's Cup. So I would say all in all, it's been a pretty successful year. But, you know, to your point, he had been talking for a couple of years about wanting to win again on the PGA Tour. It had been a while since the beginning of 2019. Perhaps, you know, the catalyst was the team victory with Patrick Cantlay. I think what's next for Xander Schauffele, you would expect, is a major championship. He's come so close, particularly at US Opens. He's often contended, but never quite been close enough to get one of those big 4 wins.
Yeah, and until this year, he'd played 18 major championships, and he'd actually finished in the top 10 and half of them. He'd been 2nd twice. He'd been 3rd twice. And it's his consistency, I think, in a way, becomes a burden on Xander, because he does, if you even look through his entire statistical profile, there are no wild fluctuations there. Everything is so solid throughout the bag, year to year. And over the last 5 seasons, he's accumulated 35, I think it is, top 10 finishes in that time. And there weren't a lot of trophies until we got to this year. And that just becomes, in a way, a burden, because you're constantly there. You're in the frame every week. And if you're not leaving with the trophy, it can become a kind of a millstone around your neck. And Xander Schauffele, to me, is proof of how difficult it is to win out there. And it's not as though he's underachieving at this point. He has 7 wins on the PGA Tour. And this year, I think, is his breakthrough the year, though. At one point, he'd fallen out of the top 10. When he missed the cut at Augusta National, he left the top 10 in the official World Golf Rankings. By the time he left the US Open, he was down to 15th. He's now up to 6th. In the world rankings, and we just saw on that full screen there why he's made his way back by clawing his way up through victories. Particularly the one that impressed me was the Genesis Scottish Open, because that was a particularly strong field, and it's an unfamiliar style of golf for most American golfers. He's proven adept at that as well, because people will tend to forget that one of his 2nd place finishes was in the Open at Carnoustie that Molinari won back in 2018. So he does have some adaptability as he moves around. He's proven a more kind of adept international player than a lot of his peers have. I think he's perfectly positioned for a breakout run. He had three solid finishes in the majors this year, but I think he's now past solid finishes. I think he wants the top finish.
I like what you said, perfectly positioned, you know, ready to pounce, perhaps. You know, the Scottish Open was so impressive because, as you mentioned before, it was in back-to-back starts. Yeah, I think back to the team events and what they can do for one's confidence. And we've just come off a President's Cup last month, and it was his President's Cup debut. In fact, his US team debut at Royal Melbourne back in 2019, part of Tiger's team. They all flew down under together. That's a very long journey from the United States. And that is when this friendship with Patrick Cantlay formed. You know, they spent ages just sitting, playing cards on the plane, realised that they're pretty similar. And as we know, have struck up this wonderful friendship that includes holidays to Napa at the end of the FedEx Cup season each year and time with each other's respective halves. I think perhaps spurring each other on the golf course too. You know, they had that team win in New Orleans. It's amazing how much he may have been able to learn from Patrick, and I'm sure vice versa. But for two people at the height of their game, so high in the world rankings, to be so close, it's rare, don't you think? You know, we've seen a Jordan Spieth and a Justin Thomas, but, you know, there must be benefits to the amount of time these two spend together, given what they do for a living.
There has to be, and it makes me wonder. You know, I've heard Rory McIlroy say in the past that everyone benefits from becoming friends with and being mentored by people who are better than you, who've accomplished more than you, because it gives you something to aim for. And it's interesting that he and Cantlay have become so close, both West Coast guys, but neither one of them has a major championship yet. Cantlay's record is considerably poorer than Xander's in major championships at this stage. But it's definitely interesting that they've bonded well together. But Xander Schauffele is also one of those characters who fits seamlessly into almost any company. Probably you can't say the same about Cantlay. He might be a slightly different fit. But Xander is also not intimidated by the competition around him. When you look at the events he wins, I mean, the Century Tournament of Champions, you've got to have won on the PGA Tour to get into that field. Obviously, the Genesis this year was a big one. And don't overlook the JP McManus Pro-Am. Xander Schauffele also walked away with that. And, you know, pretty much every big name in the game was there that week at Adair Manor in Ireland. But Xander Schauffele, you know, you can say it's a hit and giggle event. I didn't see too much giggling going on from the players over there who were pretty serious about it. And Xander Schauffele walked away with the title on that one. And that was the week of the Genesis Scottish Open. So he got two trophies for one week's work.
Yeah, you're right. He came into the Open with those wins in the Travellers, Scottish Open, you know, Adair Manor with the Pro-Am. He was in such an impressive run. And we'll see, of course, what next year holds for him as he's in his last year in his 20s and certainly knows how to celebrate. We've seen him enjoying the cigars, haven't we, at the President's and Ryder Cups.